Friday. It is the Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt, fresh off his fish convention, where they figured out the size of all the hooks and lures. How's it going?
It wasn't like that at all. Now, you know that. Right? But it was fish-related, though.
Yeah.
It was fish-adjacent.
Fish-adjacent.
Yes, we had a fish-adjacent dinner banquet party last night in the fine city of Montreal, and it was a blast.
Oh, that's great. Well, Arash Madani did a fine job filling in for you yesterday, but let's go into the weekend. On a high note, today's top story brought to you by Thornhill Toyota, your local Toyota store since 1969. Come for the history, stay for the future. Dufferin, north of Steeles. All right, Stephen, if a visit by the hapless Cincinnati Reds isn't enough to shake the Blue Jays offense loose, I don't know what is. And I know they played better recently, won 8 of their last 12. They're still the worst team in Major League Baseball. Boy, man, some of the statistics are horrifying. They have a collective ERA of 5.88. That's the worst in Major League Baseball. They're giving up almost a homer and a half per nine. That's the highest in Major League Baseball. But here's actually what's interesting. You look at only 40% of their pitches are strikes, which is 23rd in Major League Baseball. That actually might not be a good thing to wake this Blue Jays offense.
Yeah, it's you said, like they're 8 of the last 12. They're an 11-win team. They were a 3-win team, you know, not that long ago, well, 12 games ago, and we were talking about them kind of being historically bad. They don't look like that, and I guess they've got some kind of live arms, some kind of erratic live arms. The most live and somewhat erratic we're going to see on Saturday, Hunter Green, which is going to be pretty cool. But this is the part of the schedule that we talked about for the beginning of the part of the schedule we talked about for the first month and a half, saying just wait, because Jays are playing all these good teams over and over and over and again, but there's going to be a pause. They're going to get some off days. They're all going to get rested, and then they're going to get to pick on the weaklings. But now they've got to take care of business, and they didn't close out that sweep against Seattle. Seattle's not as bad a team, but they're not looking like the team they finished last year. You got to start stringing wins together. Making hay and taking advantage of these soft spots in the schedule. And they should win 3 at home against the Cincinnati Reds, who are pretty bad. But I think it'll be interesting to see what their bats look like again against some live arms, you know, maybe not totally refined arms, but definitely some live arms that the Reds can throw at them.
Yeah, and I think once you get to the bullpen, things get less live.
Yes, they do. Yes, they
do. And they do have a guy. Yeah, they do have a guy tonight that, I mean, every Blue Jays fan was salivating over the prospect of trading for, right? Luis Castillo. But yeah, he's off to a slow start. And they got Connor Overton, the former Blue Jay, on Sunday. It's just, the excuse thing is starting to disappear. They did take 2 out of 3 against Seattle, and you can't ever pencil in a sweep or say you must sweep this team. But boy, this is as close to that as you're going to get, considering where the Blue Jays find themselves, considering the narrative that's surrounding this team. They've already pulled the trigger on the players only meeting. I just let's play this out, where not only do they not sweep the Reds, but they lose this series somehow, and still the bats are ice cold on Monday after these 3 games against a team with a collective ERA almost 6. Like, at that point, I know it's only May, and you can only have a crisis to a certain degree when you are talking about a 162-game baseball season, but this was one of the World Series favorites going into the season. At a certain point here, the conversation becomes a little more serious than, these bats have really underperformed, and they're going to regress positively to the mean as far as runners in scoring position. Like, this kind of actually feels like a pretty important 3-game set.
Yeah, well, or at least, and at the beginning of an important stretch. No great judgments should be passed on baseball teams in May, but you know, there's the big asterisk here that I think we're pretty close to a different kind of conversation around this team. You know, that last game against Seattle was the way that Seattle series ended, which was kind of sour. It did feel like, despite the fact that the offense is still not rolling the way one would expect it to, that they had a chance to sweep that series. You sweep that series at home, I think everybody takes a deep breath and off we go. But the way that ended was kind of sour. That third game was not pretty. And you know, the expectations here are legitimate. The pressure's legitimate. This isn't just another season. It's a season when you expect to contend. And so where is the pressure going to focus? I think you can answer that question. you can talk about hitting coaches all you want. Like, some teams do change hitting coaches in midstream. Happened this year already. There's a guy who was one of their hitting coaches, Dante Bichette, who's not with them right now. He seemed to be doing a good job.
Yeah, bring him back.
So that'll be a conversation. And then it's not fair, but the next conversation is going to be about the manager.
No, you're absolutely right. Again, too early for any of those conversations. They're above 500, and he's not telling them to hit .180 with runners in scoring position, but the record is what it is, and the offense is what it is to this point. Let's talk to our pal, John Morosi of MLB Network. How is it going, John?
I am outstanding, gentlemen. Just back from Fenway Park. Saw two different teams come through Boston, so I have some fresh AL East observations for you. And on the topic that you mentioned about the Jays' struggles with runners in scoring position, I do think that Dan Schulman made some very good points when he was on the network this morning about the Jays, how they're being pitched this year differently, specifically Vlad. I think some adjustments need to be made there.
Yeah. And you know, Shai Davidi with a great write-up on Sportsnet.ca today as well about what Vlad is going through, the adjustments that he knows need to be made, and some of the adjustments that are being made on the fly. But you know, I just wonder from an overall, an outsider baseball perspective, John, this Blue Jays offense, which actually, you know, as far as OPS Plus, it's been pretty close to a league average offense, which is crazy to imagine considering how anemic it feels. But yeah, baseball is off to a very slow start offensively. Do you still believe that this offense can be an upper echelon offense as currently constructed?
You know, it's a great question, Ben, and I think partially it hinges on what our expectation is and what the behavior of the baseball is for the balance of the season. I think that, to me, is one of the realities of where the Jays are struggling right now. And maybe, and this is not unique to them because it's been happening to every team, patterns of offensive approach that yielded home runs last year and worked last year are not working as often this year. Now, they're working sometimes, but not, broadly speaking, as often. And that is where you now need to make the adjustment. To take that big step back and sort of the larger picture, the reason why the launch angle school of thought exists, and Tom Verducci's talked about this a lot, and I think it's correct, it's the reason why it exists is the stuff from pitchers is so good that stringing together three hits in an inning to move someone from first to second, maybe you score from second with a base hit, that doing that is really hard. And that is why you've seen this all-or-nothing methodology of a lot of offensive players. Now, I think what we're seeing now is that the all-or-nothing method isn't working as much because the ball isn't traveling as far. So we have to now see, okay, can we relearn what we had unlearned in the last several years, which is maybe we do need to put the ball in play in a little bit of a different way, because if the ball's not leaving the yard, you got to make the best you can with what you can do in the yard. And I just think that we're seeing some teams, the Jays among them, that I think get caught in the trap of taking too many similar approaches. And this is where I think the Jays' vulnerability to really good right-handed pitching is there. It is a right-handed, power-centric lineup that does not do a whole lot else. I mean, if you have an approach that says, I'm not going to give these righties anything they hit on the inner half of the plate, then you kind of have that same process all the way through. You don't have Anthony Rizzo or Rafael Devers to break it up, to mention two prominent lefty bats from this same division. There is no Rizzo in this lineup, nor is there a Devers. And I think that at some point in time, the bill for that comes due if the ball is not leaving the yard off of Vlad's bat as often as it was last year. And you take a look at the big picture here. With Vlad's numbers still good, but not as extraordinary as they were last year, the Jays are around a 500 team. They're a little better than that, but that's basically what they are. He took them from a good team to a great one last year for stretches of the season, and without that happening, they look like a good but rather ordinarily good ball club right now.
Although, you know, John, I think you're right about that. But, you know, in Vladdy's case, what the current circumstances seem to have done, which I guess, you know, the baseball to a degree, but also the way he's being pitched and maybe the way the lineup around him is hitting, and might be just as important who's hitting behind him. But he seems to be a guy now who, you know, because people are talking about his launch angle for the opposite reason. He's turned into a singles hitter. You know,
right.
he's hitting a ground ball single every game, or sometimes a line drive single. But those, you know, the big, those mammoth shots that he hit, which, you know, even with a dead ball, if he was hitting it as square as he did last year, they'd still go. He looks like he did before, early in his career, when people said he was hitting too many ground balls.
Right. No, he is. And I was actually, I was speaking with someone on the Mariners side yesterday at Fenway, because, of course, they had just played the Jays. And I said, how's Vladdy look? And the response I got was that he's not driving the ball, and that they thought that maybe his lower half was not as involved in the swing as it was last year. Now, that could be something as simple as just maybe he's out of balance, whatever it is. The stride is different. As you guys know, the smallest difference in a stride or hand position, how it syncs up with your hands, it can cause dramatically different results. That's just the way hitting works, and why it's such a mystery for so many of us to watch and watch the masters at what they do. But it doesn't take a lot to get into, if not a bad habit, a suboptimal habit. And for whatever reason, I think to your point and to Shai's reporting and what Dan has said too, he's being pitched a little differently. And the ball, you're not quite getting rewarded for a slightly mishit ball leaving the yard anymore. And so if that happens once every two or three games where a ball that, man, last year was traveling those extra 10 feet and getting out of the park as opposed to being a deep fly out, that changes the numbers dramatically. That's an extra two homers a week when you think about it. So I think that's part of what's happening, but that's the assessment, again, of one of the Mariner folks I spoke with yesterday just said doesn't look like himself from last year. And it could just be a minor thing. I can't speculate on what's going on in terms of if there's anything physical there. I don't know. But it just, that is what the baseball person's observation was that I spoke with yesterday, was that he's not driving the same way with his lower half and not driving the baseball. And when he's not driving the baseball, it's just not quite the same Toronto lineup.
No, he looks like the guy that first broke into the major leagues, honestly, who was hitting the ball on the ground really hard, but hitting the ball on the ground routinely. You know what this team needs? Juan Soto. John, tell us something good about Juan Soto and his availability, because, yeah, Buster only sent shockwaves through the city of Toronto by including, like, a little nugget about his potential availability. There's just so much team control remaining on that deal. I mean, the ownership situation in Washington is, I guess, the reason why you could maybe squint and see the possibility of the Nationals moving him. How do you see that thing playing out here before the deadline?
Well, I think it's an interesting question, and when you look at it, big picture, you know, one thing we've seen is that unless you're the Yankees or the Dodgers, typically if you've got a marquee player that is coming up on free agency, and if you don't have an extension with them in place, when you're about 2 years out or a little longer, the rumblings start. And it was even true for, I would say, Mookie Betts is probably the closest example of someone who is in this stratosphere of being just an exceptional player, and maybe Soto is a better pure hitter than probably Mookie is. I mean, he's just, to me, Soto's one of the best bats we've seen in really a generation. And so if you're not going to sign him, you have to at least explore the possibility of trading him, as jarring as that might seem. And I will say this for Toronto's perspective. They do have two guys, I think, in Martinez and Moreno in the minor leagues who do have that kind of carrying value, who could be the lead pieces in a deal for a player of Soto's caliber. I'm not going to say that they're the favorites because I don't think we're anywhere close to that right now. And I would always say, and this is something that Doug Melvin said to me, of course, the great native of Chatham, Ontario, years and years ago, he said, you almost always, if you're going to trade a position player, a marquee guy, you're almost always going to get more value in the offseason because teams can arrange their offseason around that move. And that was sort of how it went with Giancarlo Stanton years ago, if you recall that, when he was traded, sort of like held up the entire market of everybody because a lot of the marquee teams were involved and they wanted to wait until that process worked its way through. And so I really think that if you were to ask me now, what are the chances Soto was still a National on August 3rd? I still think it's probably better than 50-50. Maybe it's like 70-30 he stays. Maybe it's even higher than that. I just think they would have to be overwhelmed by a package of prospects. But I do think this. With Toronto, you at least have the sort of carrying value with those two guys, Martinez and Moreno. And also what we articulated a moment ago, I mean, he is precisely what the Jays need. Now, he's precisely what a lot of teams need. Giants are another one of them. You can go right down the list. But I do think that especially because of where this Jays team is, how right-handed they are, and how good the farm system is, you can see it. There's a natural fit. But at what point in time do you say no? If they say, hey, we'll trade them, but we better get Orelvis Martinez and Alek Manoah. Then what do you say? Because I'm not going to say that that's exactly what they would ask for, but it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt to get a player of this caliber, and that's why I think it's fun to think about, and the Jays do have the right fit, but I'm just not convinced that he's going to get traded this summer. I do think that if they can't extend him, and they probably won't be able to, he probably will get moved, but the Jays also have to. The other tertiary thought is, if you bring him in, are you okay with realizing that he's probably going to go to free agency? And then what do you do with Vladdy? At some point in time, you got to pay him or Bo. I mean, there's a lot of down the line thoughts the Jays have to entertain about what that payroll is going to look like for years to come.
Yeah, I'd still just back the truck up and give them what they want.
Correct.
But I just can't look from. I can't understand from. I guess maybe the we should, rather than talk about whether the Jays would like him, because they would, or anybody,
exactly.
Everybody in baseball. He's 23, for God's sakes. Like, it's unbelievable. He would be
right.
He'd be a foundation piece, even for the 2 years. That would be just fine. But what is happening with that Washington? That team is supposed to be sold. They're really bad. They're not that far removed from winning a World Series, but you kind of wonder, what it's going to be like if they continue to crater this season, and you're looking at a long walk through the desert in a market that is, it has been a tricky market for baseball historically.
Right.
Do the new owners, are you going to have an absolute fire sale there before you put the thing on the market? Are you trying to retain value before wouldn't you like to sell Juan Soto with your team to make it worth more?
Right.
And what about and there's some other, the other piece there, of course, which is a little more realistic, is Josh Bell, who
right.
would be a nice fit as well.
No, that's a good point. And Bell, I mean, there's a lot of teams. It's amazing, just in my travels this year, the number of teams that are getting very little production out of first base. It's surprising. Boston is one that obviously I just saw play that comes to mind most prominently. I mean, just they really don't have enough production there. And so I think Bell would fit. And I do think that the point that you make about the sale is interesting, because you're right, Steve. You can look at it one of two ways. Either the franchise is more valuable when you've got a marketable superstar that people want to pay to see. The other side is, if you don't think that you can find a way, and right now the Nationals probably have a pretty good sense of this by talking to Scott Boras, if you don't think you can match his price, if his price starts with a four, $400 million, and if you can't get up there, then if you can't get to that point, then the new owner might not be able to get there either. And do you want your first act as the new owner to be, I'm going to trade Juan Soto? I mean, that's a pretty hard thing to do as your very first thing to do once you inherit the club. So a lot of interesting things for the Nationals to think about. And I do think, Steve and Ben, that the sale dynamic adds another layer of complexity.
Yeah, it absolutely does. Before we let you go, John, because you had such a close look at this Red Sox team, which came up with a big win yesterday, and Trevor Story, I guess, you know, he's maybe starting to break out. Three homers will do that for you. It's only May, and they're only six games under 500. How do you see the rest of the season playing out for that Red Sox team? Because, you know, early on it just felt like they were dead and buried. Do they have a resurrection in their future?
Well, it's an interesting question, Ben, because we were talking about this, and Bob Costas made the point, working with Bob on the broadcast this week, that really the team that Boston has to be aware of and have in their sights is Toronto. Because it does seem, when you look at the way that the dynamics work out of these of the divisions of the American League, the Central is obviously down. So you think that with the expanded wild card, Toronto is the team that Boston has to chase down. I think Boston's rotation, you know, Chris Sale is a mystery. Who knows when he's going to come back? They have had good success. Michael Wacha's pitched pretty well. He comes back from the injured list today. Pivetta, of course, the Canadian, outstanding right-hander. He had a complete game this week. I think they're getting some traction. And if Story can play well, if he keeps on this trajectory and he joins what's been a very formidable big three of Bogarts, Martinez, and Devers, and if Kike can get on base and create some havoc there, they'll score plenty of runs. And their bullpen is really been challenging for them to figure out. That they've got a guy, John Schreiber, who's pitched pretty well lately, but the bullpen they have to address. But if Story continues like this, they're a team that Toronto's going to have to be aware of, because they can get hot and reel off 10 wins in 12 games just hitting the ball as long as the bullpen cooperates. So I think you're right to ask about that team, because they're getting a little bit of momentum right now, and I do think Boston-Toronto is going to be the collision for a playoff spot before the season is done.
John, always great to chat. Thanks for this.
All the best, guys. Have a wonderful weekend. I look forward to next week as well.
Sounds good. See you, John. John Morosi, MLB Network. If you're a Jays fan, you hope that that's not a collision course at the end of the season. I think more than the Red Sox resurrecting themselves, it means that the Blue Jays have underperformed, because I would think if the Blue Jays still have their sights on the top of this division, because eventually the Yankees are going to run out of Orioles games to play, and eventually they're going to cool off a little bit. They're quite good. They are good, and that bullpen is a little bit ridiculous. I think the Blue Jays have a better rotation, and I question whether Stanton and Judge can stay healthy for, and Donaldson for that matter, and LeMahieu can stay healthy for the entire season. But yeah, it's a bad scene if you're battling it out with the Red Sox for a playoff spot.
I was wrong about the Red Sox last year. We're all wrong about the Red Sox last year. But I just, I look at that starting pitching, like the bullpen. What John said was challenging. You know, it's a mess, right? And I know bullpens can get fixed midseason, and they can also fall apart midseason. So, sure, you can address that. But their rotation, unless Chris Sale comes back and is Chris Sale, and I know Pivetta just had the great start, but you know, we've seen a fair bit of Nick Pivetta, you know, and I know he's one of us, and that's great. But, I don't think they've got the horses in terms of pitching. I think they've got to be a better offensive team than they've shown at times this year, just because of the guys we were just talking about. But no, I don't. I think the hierarchy, like that's not saying they're not going to get back into it to some degree, but the Jays shouldn't be afraid of that. If you put the Jays pitching up against their pitching, it's not a contest right now.
No.
But and I think, you know, look, the other thing is, I think, Ben, if you look at the American League, you know, it's you know, coming up on Victoria Day weekend, it's really early, but I think the hierarchy is kind of there. Like, I think you can kind of tell who the contending teams are. We already have the class structure of the American League. Like, you know, Minnesota's playing a little better than I think you might have thought they would be, but the White Sox are starting to come close the gap there. You know, the Angels look like maybe they're finally figuring it out. So the Angels in Houston in the West, and three teams in the East right now.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, so divide up those. You know, I think right now you've got one more contending team than you have playoff spot, maybe, or maybe you have exactly the same. I'm just trying to do that in my head, but it's not, you know, like the big surprise, like, oh, this is Detroit's going to make a big leap this year, or Kansas City is going to. It's not happening, right? And I think Cleveland are probably doomed to be just a little bit better than, you know, a little bit better than 500, or a little bit worse than 500. Like, I think, you know, unless something dramatic happens there. So yeah, I think you know. You know what the kind of look, what the postseason pool looks like already.
all right, we ran out of time in this segment, but you raised his name and you raised this possibility, so I'm going to give you time to think about it, but I'm going to bring the question back around to you, because anyone can trade all the prospects in the world for Juan Soto. Sure, you've never seen him. Gabriel Moreno, he's just a thought. Aurelvis Martinez, he's just some highlights from spring training. You raised Alek Manoah. And that's you know what?
No, Morosi raised it. Morosi raised it. So, and Morosi will do anything, as you know.
All right, you think on that, because we are going to revisit. Would you? It would definitely require more than Alek Manoah, but Alek Manoah would be the centerpiece of any Juan Soto deal. Blue Jays fans need to think on that one. And whether you'd give up the, one of the top 10 American League Cy Young candidates at the moment in year two of his major league service. That would kind of be the structure of a deal for one of the best lefty sluggers in all of baseball. But that was today's top story, brought to you by Thornhill Toyota. When we come back, the Battle of Alberta resumes tonight very, very late. Put on a pot of coffee. 10:30 puck drop between the Flames and Oilers. We'll talk to Jennifer Botterill, Hockey Night in Canada, and the NHL on TNT next as the Fan Drive Time continues. Ben Annis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Drive Time, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. And no matter how late I stay up, I can only have two coffees. Two coffees a day, or else my stomach is turning over. I don't know how the people working on Hockey Night in Canada are going to stay up to watch multiple overtimes of Game 2 of the Battle of Alberta, which starts, puck drop is after 10:30 tonight in Alberta. Flames up one game to none on the Oilers. Jennifer Botterill has it all figured out, I'm sure. She of Hockey Night in Canada and the NHL on TNT. What are you going to do, Jen? Are you multiple coffees?
No, I had a short pregame nap. I'm not a coffee person. Maybe a little tea, but the pregame nap is critical.
Yeah, I love that. I'm a big nap person as well. All right, are we on high alert that Mike Smith might be going through it a little bit here? He'd been so good during the postseason, but that was a jarring performance in game one.
Okay, but he's also been able to respond previously from mistakes or errors or not being as smart as he potentially should be in terms of his performance. So this is a tough one. You look at both the goaltenders, if you look at Markstrom and you look at Smith, and they had to be really good in their first round in terms of, if you look at Edmonton and must win game six and then force game seven and then Calgary and the unbelievable overtime. So you just wonder, they want to be excited for round two, but if there was just a little bit of a mental lapse for Smith, obviously a really tough start for him. But after it was all said and done at the end of game one, he was the one that had the least goals scored against him. So, but I do think that he's shown in the past, though, that he doesn't tend to let mistakes or errors bother him. And whether it's in his comments, but he at times he's followed that up and responded. In game one, he had a couple sort of misplays early in round one, but then came back and played really strong for them.
Those goals per minute wasn't that great, right? So that's
fair enough. No question.
or per second. But Jen, I guess the one question that with him would be the workload, because this kind of grind. Obviously didn't have this season. He's at a certain stage in career and life. I'm sympathetic to stages of career and life, because we do wear it down. That's why I can't stay up till 2 a.m. But I wonder mentally, sure, and he's been here before, but is there a possibility he's just worn out?
But people were saying that before the month of April, and he was incredible in the month of April, right? So I think there's this question mark with him, perhaps, and conversation that followed him throughout the season. Can he be the guy that Edmonton needs him to be in terms of that consistency, and giving them a chance to be successful. And then he ended up showing up big time in April and had exceptional numbers and played really strong for them towards the end of the season. So it's tough. Yeah, I mean, this is a different category. You just finished a seven-game series, and there is a demand on your body. But, I mean, time is going to tell if it's, you know, the age factor at this point in his career, or if it was just a little bump in the road and he's able to respond and to come back and to perform the way that he wants to.
Yeah, you mentioned the guy on the other side of the ice wasn't exactly great either. Markstrom was mm-hmm. pretty brutal, and the Oilers come all the way back and tie that game up at six before the Flames put it away with three straight goals. I mean, if you're looking for positives out of the Oilers camp, is that not one of them, that at least they've shown that they can get to this guy after he was so good? I mean, after they played so many tight games in that Stars series, that you lit him up a little bit, that you were able to create offense against a team that didn't allow anything against the Dallas Stars.
Well, absolutely, right? And they had to be so good against Dallas. And Markstrom, he had to be so focused and so dialed in as well. I mean, there was a lot of attention in that previous series against Dallas with Ottinger, who was just playing, you know, better than he ever had. And just, I think there's a lot of focus on him, but Markstrom had to make some huge saves. And I mean, the whole thing with Calgary, right, is that they've bought into the Sutter philosophy and playing strong defensively. And that's why game one was such a surprise for everybody. But yes, if you're looking at Edmonton's perspective and point of view, they have to believe. I mean, they know what they have up front. And with, I mean, McDavid was great, of course, in game one. And when you think that he's at his highest level, he seems to get even better. And for Markstrom to show that, oh, he has a little bit of humanity as well, and had, you know, three goals that went in, sort of touched his glove and then went under or went over them. Certainly that's something, if you're Edmonton, you're saying, oh, well, let's just make sure that we keep this going and try to keep him a little unnerved. But he's also a guy that had such a great season in terms of how many shutouts he had, how consistent he was for Calgary. You'd certainly expect him to come back with a sense of resolve and a strong performance in game two.
I wonder what Daryl said to them, you know, after, maybe, and maybe not much, because, you know, he's sometimes a man of few words, but after that game, because they came out and looked great, you know, jumped on an Edmonton team that didn't look ready to play, and had the game, and then had the game under control, completely under control, and then it all falls apart for a variety of reasons, and then they come back and, you know, they still close it out and they win the game and all of that. But it'd be a strange one for, you know, because it was definitely not a Daryl Sutter team kind of performance, and yet they showed some stuff on either end of it. They kind of bookended weird stuff in the middle with things that made them look like they could dominate the series.
Right. I mean, it was just a wild game in so many different ways, but I think if you're at this point in the playoffs and you're a coach and talking to the team, you're going to pull out the positives. And yes, they're going to want to tighten up and get back a little more so to the style that they want to play. But if you're going to look at some things they can build upon, I mean, their top line was so good all year. And even, I mean, against Edmonton, maybe they do feel like they have the space that they need to create, you know, scenes in the offensive zone. I mean, Gaudreau was flying. You look at Tkachuk, who had the hat trick, and you know, there's no question his family was loving it in the stands and so happy to see him playing well. But if you're Calgary, you're just thinking, those are also things you want to build upon. I mean, it was, they had to be resilient against Dallas. I mean, they had to, you know, they were getting so many shots against Ottinger. And if that's one thing, it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy by any means to get to this round. And that's something that at times can be beneficial for a team. When you've dealt with adversity and now it was a game one you wouldn't have predicted, but maybe there are some benefits. I mean, Anderson, you know, on D to come up and step up and play well with Tanev out. And then you got this first line that's flying. You got Coleman that came in and had a couple huge goals. And so I think there's elements, certainly from a coaching perspective, that you feel like can sort of continue to build your confidence and your belief moving forward in this series.
Who knew you could be a sponsored fan? Brady Tkachuk today signed a deal with Budweiser. Yeah, so if you go nuts enough, a beer company will give you money. I mean, you probably have to have the last name Tkachuk. Like, I feel like if I'm caught on camera cheering like that, Budweiser's probably not ringing me up. But that was impressive, Jen.
It was. You know what? I love it, though. And you've heard all the comments, whether it's Matthew talking about it or the family talking about it. Yeah, it's Brady. It's his, but it's his sister. It's his dad. And all of their comments are, they feel like Matthew would do the same thing for Brady. And they do the same thing for their sister when she's playing university sports. And that's what I think is so great about this. Yeah, he's having a great time. But I feel like this is a pretty special family. And it's just, those were the comments. You know, we do this for each other. If it was a different person from that family in the same situation, they'd each do the same thing. So I think it's been pretty neat to see.
Yeah, I expect my two children to do the same when they reach the NHL. Which
it's a goal.
It would be sponsored.
I thought you'd train to be sponsored fans. I think that's you should encourage them. It's a career path.
Not necessarily what I meant, but yeah, you know what? Whatever pays the bills. After the game, neither coach was obviously all that pleased, but Jay Woodcroft did, you know, mention Connor McDavid leading the Oilers in hits, which is, I guess, good for Connor McDavid, but not ideal for the Oilers. What are you expecting physically from Edmonton tonight?
Well, physically, to be strong, right? I mean, McDavid has certainly, during these playoffs, demonstrated he can deliver physicality, no question. He did the same thing against the Kings, had some huge hits early in Game 7 against the Kings. But he also took some big hits from Calgary. And so I guess that's also to be expected in the playoffs, and perhaps even more so if you're going to deliver them and dish them. But I think that they know that Calgary is a team that can play physically really strong and really tight on you. So I'm sure they'll be ready for that style of game.
Jen, the other side of the I think a lot of us kind of conceded the at least a conference final berth to Colorado going into this playoff. But boy, that series has taken an interesting turn. I know there's some a few folks. Our pal Greg Wyshynski had picked St. Louis to win that series. Actually, picked whoever won that St. Louis Minnesota series to beat Colorado. So maybe you know something the rest of us don't know. But boy, that suddenly looks like a contest, doesn't it?
Does. And if you think, you know, we were talking about coaches in this battle of Alberta. I mean, that's one. If you look at Berube, I actually covered at ice level that St. Louis, Minnesota game 6. And the theme throughout that series was that for St. Louis, Berube was able to make adjustments, right? He changed the goaltenders, made line combinations. And we're seeing that already in this series against Colorado, that he's made some adjustments to their lineup, made changes to that top line. They ended up going up and having a great game and making adjustments even to the power play and having guys in different situations. And I think that's just so essential for a coach to have that kind of a pulse on your team and to know what kind of adjustments you can make to have them be successful. And I mean, they have a lot of guys that know what it takes, and they can be a tough team. Maybe some of those guys aren't going to be the fastest guys on the ice, but they're smart, and they know how to find their space in the offensive zone. And, I mean, certainly Colorado still looks really strong in terms of what they have and how they can play, but it certainly looks like St. Louis is going to make it to a competitive series.
Jen, before we let you go, obviously Leaf fans paying pretty close attention to that Battle of Florida happening right now, where the two-time defending Stanley Cup champion Tampa Bay Lightning are up 2-0. The Panthers were the highest-scoring team in the salary cap era, and during the regular season, they scored fewer than 2 goals only 3 times. They've now done it twice in 3 days. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just feels like this is once again another example of if you succeed during the regular season by just bludgeoning people offensively, there is no way that carries over into this time of year.
Yes, and it's also a huge credit to Tampa Bay as well in terms of how they're playing. And if you look at what they've done, I remember talking to Cooper about a month and a half ago, and they just, you know, even they had a couple games later in the regular season, where they could let question marks, but then they just had this collective belief, right? They feel like they've had this taste of success, and it only wants, you know, has sort of encourage them to want even more. And it was the same. I talked to Stamkos about a month ago, and he was just so, I think, determined, right? He's had so much success, that has achieved a lot through injury in his career. And you've seen what they did. I mean, even in the game for them last night, how many guys left and went to the locker room, came back out? And you go through, whether it's Cooper, Stamkos, they talk about McDonough being this guy who's just the stable force for them. And he, you know, Cooper thought he was probably the runner-up for the Conn Smythe to Vasilevskiy last year. And then these plays that Kucherov makes in the last few seconds of the game, and you've got guys, whether it was Paul in the Toronto season and Colton getting that winner with a few seconds. You go through that roster, and guys are stepping up, and I feel like they've just got this. They're driven. They want to create this dynasty in Tampa Bay. So, yeah, a reflection of maybe what you need to do or adjustments that Florida needs to make, but I also feel like huge credit to Tampa Bay.
Yeah. It would be an honor to lose to them in a 7-game series, in Game 7, only decided by one goal. Jen, enjoy the late night. Hopefully
Thank
it's
you.
Like only like 4 or 5 overtimes tonight.
Thank you kindly. Nice to chat with you guys.
All right. See you, Jen. Jennifer Botterill, Hockey Night in Canada in the NHL on TNT. See, they're really good, Steven. You see? And yeah, I keep every day I have this call with our producer, Mike Gentile, noted Habs fan. Every single win that the Lightning rack up in this series, it's, you know, another year on the contract extension for Kyle Dubas and Sheldon Keefe is his big joke. Which is a joke that you're allowed to make when this organization does, you know, exalt in the one goal loss in Game 7 and Game 6 going to overtime. It's so hard because there's two things here. Because, yeah, they lost. They lost. And they lost again, right? Fifth straight year they've lost a winner-take-all postseason game. But as much as, like, my tongue is firmly in my cheek, it is also true that team is quite good and potentially about to throw out the President's Trophy champions for the second straight year. So, I don't know. The sport is weird, but you can joke all you want about it. It is true that Lightning team appears quite good.
Yes. Now, I won't return to the point I made a couple of days ago, which is that last year, of course, the Leafs lost to a team that went to the Stanley Cup final. But,
Because
there's all kinds of asterisks attached, and we all know that, right? So we don't have to even talk about that. But, yes, the Toronto Maple Leafs may have been within a bad 5-on-3, first penalty of which may have been a phantom call in a third period that they were dominating of eliminating the three-time Stanley Cup champion Tampa Bay Lightning, right? Like that, or a team that is at least going to play in the conference final, or is going to roll the President's Choice or the President's Trophy team in the second round. So that, yes, does that feel better? I guess this is the question, right? Does this? It's not illogical to say, boy, you know, they played they played them a hell of a lot better than Florida's played them so far. They were way more competitive than Florida is. So therefore they were the second best team in the conference this year and just by a hair. So does that make you feel better? Should that play to anyone's job security? Do they give you a prize for that? You get a ribbon?
Booby prize. I don't know.
I don't know, but that's it. Look, it may
Everybody
be true,
gets
though,
a
man.
Ribbon. Yeah.
But it may be true. If they're the second best team in the conference?
Yeah, well, I don't know. The sports aren't fair.
By a hair. Just a smidge.
Well, you know what? Maybe the Bruins were right there too, right? They despite not having a single lead against the Hurricanes for so much, well, the entire regular season and then the first two games of this series, come back and make a series of it, get to a Game 7 against the Hurricanes and bow out. And I will say, there was a stark contrast in the way Bruins president Cam Neely talked about his organization, his head coach, after all was said and done, as opposed to Brendan Shanahan, who stood up at the dais with his general manager and said, everybody's coming back. Here's what Cam Neely said about Bruce Cassidy. I think we have to look at making some changes as far as how we play and how we do some of the things. I think Bruce is a fantastic coach. He's brought a lot of success to this organization. I like him as a coach. So we'll see where it goes. I do think we need to make some changes. And I think Bruce, a couple of days ago, alluded to that. So we'll see where that goes. Gotta say, Bruce Cassidy, probably want to throw out some feelers out there as far as your next job is concerned. But here's Bruce Cassidy's resume as the head coach of the Boston Bruins. Been in the playoffs all 6 years. Only twice has he lost in the first round. He's made it to the Cup Finals. It was this year he lost in the first round, and his first kick at the can in 16-17 lost in the first round. Other than that, he's been in the second round three times and went to the Cup Final once, which is significantly better than Sheldon Keefe, I would mention, and even he is not getting the stamp of approval.
I'm not sure that's management 101 to start with. If Brendan Shanahan or Kyle Dubas had said something along those lines, like there would be clouds of buzzards circling, vultures circling the Scotiabank Arena. It would be a frenzy. You know exactly what would have happened. It seems, you know, if he does like him as a coach and as a person and all that stuff, it's a horrible thing to do to him, but. I don't know that I can make an argument that the Bruins underachieved this year and have underachieved at any time during Cassidy's tenure. I think probably the opposite. I do think, though, look, I think you either have to endorse somebody or you have to fire them. I don't know that there's a middle ground, which is kind of like, you know, somebody better comes along. You know, maybe we'll replace them. You can't kind of go back now and say, yeah, you know, actually, in hindsight, you know, we didn't really need to make a change there. It's a very difficult. So I think what was going on there is maybe Cam Neely was actually kind of being honest. But you don't generally do that in a press situation where you say what you think and you're still working it out in your head and you actually haven't made the decision yet. But you don't say that in front of people ever.
No. There's a lot of conflicting sentences here. I think Bruce is a fantastic coach. I like him as a coach. But I do think we need some changes. I think Bruce a couple of days ago alluded to that. We'll see where that goes.
But doesn't that sound like that Bruce. Sounds like something he might have said over, you know, a beer to somebody, that Cam Neely saying, geez, I don't know what we're gonna do. I don't know if we need to change the coach or not, but you know, he's pretty good and he's done some good stuff, but maybe they just need a new voice in the room. But yeah, it's like your working notes before you make the speech. You know, you don't show everybody your working notes and say, by the way, this is the thought process. You'd want that fully formed before you went in front of the press. So horrible situation for Cassidy.
I think maybe you can come back to him and say, yeah, no, and we thought about it, and you're still our guy. It might be a Barry Trotz thing, too, right? Like the Dallas Stars, they're looking for a new head coach today as well. We already know Barry Trotz is interviewed with the Winnipeg Jets. Feels like Vegas is a pretty good landing spot for Barry Trotz. I wonder how many of these teams who have had success – who you can point to and say they kind of know what to do. Like they kind of have a good idea about how to create a winning hockey team. How many of these teams are going to be in on Barry Trotz, who the Maple Leafs said not even thinking about it? And of course they're going to say that publicly, but that appears to be their actual modus operandi because, Brendan Shanahan said everybody's coming back. I guess he could totally reverse course here, but at least some of these organizations that have had success in the last half decade are saying, we're kind of open to the idea of that guy that won the cup in the place where they hadn't won one in the tenure of one of the greatest goal scorers in the history of this league.
Yes, even those teams that, like Boston, they're still kind of keeping the old girlfriend around just in case, right? If this doesn't work out, there's a bit of that vibe. I tell you, going into this offseason, I did not anticipate that the Barry Trotz feeding frenzy would be the number one story.
Oh, but it is.
But it is.
No, it absolutely is.
Anything he wants. He'll get anything he wants.
I just hope for one moment in my life, in my career, I can have the type of leverage that Barry Trotz has. Now, it would take, you know, more than one person wanting me. so working on that. But yeah, that would be a pretty good spot to be. You know what? I hope I'm in that place and selling my house. That, you know, I have the leverage of two people loving my house. They're just willing to do battle over it. By the way, if you want to buy a house in Oakville, give me a call. Look at offload it. All right, we'll be back with more. We'll get back into that Alec Manoah thought and Joey Votto as well as the Fan Drive Time continues. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.